Every successful person got there by going through tough times. Success is a hard-ass teacher who likes to knock you around along that journey. You know, it takes real guts to not give up and keep going. We'll hear stories about failures and how these leaders flipped the script to create success. I'm John Schultz. Join me and let's discover how success is never really overnight. Welcome to the John Schultz podcast. I have a friend, a guest, a fun all-around guy. So excited to have him on the podcast. His name is Vic Rallo. How you doing, Vic?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, so glad you're doing this. So Vic is a chef, a restaurateur, a television personality, an author, loves food, unbelievable restaurants. He owns Birravino, which is in Red Bank, New Jersey, Andici, Taverna Rustica, Surf Bar and Grill, all in Rumson. And his newest thing, which I can't wait to go to, is Pastavina in Staten Island. Vic, you do a lot of things. You've been a lot of things. You went to law school at Seton Hall. You also, graduated Villanova University.
Barely.
But you got through it, right? That's the whole point. That's all that matters. So thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here.
All right. So, this is all about the myth of overnight success. And obviously you have, tremendous success, but I want to go all the way back. You're a food guy, a wine guy. You love experiences. You deliver those every day to all your customers. But what would you say was your earliest memories of being around food? Like, how'd you even get into this?
I just wrote a letter recently to people that are on our mailing list, and we write these letters periodically, and we wrote a letter about hospitality. And when I realized what hospitality was, and I was about 8 years old, and my dad opened a restaurant, Molly's Fish Market in Oakland, New Jersey, and it was a soft opening. And it was family and friends the night or two before the grand opening. And my mom got us these corduroy suits. It was like November, Italian loafers, my brother and I, white shirt. And, I remember that it was busy. There was a lot of people. And obviously we knew the chef and the people that worked there because we were around often. I kind of grew up in the restaurant business. And when I say grew up, like really grew up in the restaurant business, my mom and dad had no money. There was no like babysitter or nanny. Like we came to the restaurants, And that night at the soft opening, we butlered all the hors d'oeuvres, my brother and I. And, after that night, I understood what a soft opening was and what my mom and dad did every night to make people happy, and started to understand what hospitality was and why it was so important to them, and how it's become so important to me. So I was 7, 8 years old.
That's amazing. So that was your first day of work, basically, right? At 7 or 8 years of age.
Yeah. We were around a lot, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. But, in those early years, you learn so much. You're like a sponge, So, I learned a lot about food and people and what it took to be successful very, very early on. And, the funny thing is my dad and mom didn't want us to be in the restaurant business because it's a hard business. And they forced us to go to law school. So graduated Villanova, went to Seton Hall Law because they thought we would take a path of law. And, hospitality, food, tomato sauce is in our blood. It's kind of genetic, I guess.
So how would your parents describe you?
Both of my parents are deceased, but, they would, they definitely knew I was hardworking at an early age. I just wanted to be in it, and I worked really hard. And I think one of the greatest things a parent can give a child is understanding what work is. And I think a lot, it's lost in America. I think that kind of that attribute of people wanting to work really hard, like the American dream. Everybody wants things handed to them on a silver platter, and it doesn't happen like that. It just doesn't happen. You know, people get lucky. That's the very few, right? But it's all about hard work. And you look at, you know, the great successes in business today in America, and most of them, it was hard work, you know, or ingenuity or an idea, you know, and a lot of people have ideas that are great ideas that never make it because they're unwilling to fail to find success. And I think you talk about great leaders and great business people, and all of those people understand failure because the only way to succeed is through failure, because that failure makes you better and work harder.
It's so true. I had this gentleman, Uri Levine. He founded Waze. He wrote a book, Fall in Love with the Problem, Not the Solution, which basically, you know, every problem leads to something going wrong. And that's what teaches you how to move forward. I love that. So, wow. So you started young. Did you continue to work at the, I mean, I know you obviously went there when you were younger, but what happened as you got a little bit older, and what made you decide to work in and around the restaurants, you know, as you got older?
I worked in the restaurant from 14 or 15 on, like on weekends, whatever. And then by 16, fully like bartending, catering, like whatever we had to do. In fact, when I got my driver's license, my dad used to have a guy that went to the fish market in and the fish market in New York City, Fulton Fish Market. And he had a van. And once I got my license, he thought it was fine that my brother and I went to the fish market a couple times a week. And we would leave at midnight or 1 o'clock, pick up fish, do the run, bring it back, unload it, and go to school. And people were like, oh, we work so hard. Oh, we had this. And we used to do it twice a week and went to the market. Like it was like Tuesdays and Fridays or Tuesdays and Saturdays. And me and my brother would go in the van. I was 17. He was 16. 18, 17, whatever it was. And we would drive to Fulton Fish Market in the Bronx, buy the fish, pick it up, drop it off back at the restaurant, hose the van, go home. My mother would have breakfast, take a shower and go to school. So from early on, I saw all of it. And with my dad, it wasn't like a choice. It was like, this is what you're going to do.
So what were some of the challenges of that? Because listen, I mean, I get it, you know, you worked hard, you enjoyed it, but you know, a lot of people also, they're in sports, they do other things when they're younger to sort of get away, you know.
Yeah, what was your social life was, you know, it was a zero. Like there was very little social life because on the days you went to the market, when you got home those days, you did your homework, you were exhausted, you know, so you probably went to bed at 7 or 8 o'clock at night to catch up. And then we worked at the restaurant. So I mean, of course, we had a social life, but it was very, very important to my dad, especially that we worked. And I would say that all of my three children have worked in the restaurant, waiter, bartender, whatever, through their college, high school, and parts of their college career. And I would say that every person, especially today, should learn it because it teaches you how to talk to people. And oftentimes people are on their cell phone or iPad or computer, and kids that are 15 to 25 years old can't get off of them. They don't look you in the eye. They don't know how to talk to people. They can't have a conversation. They're out to dinner with friends and they're texting instead of talking. You know, so the people skills that I have, I attribute 100% to my early days working in a restaurant.
I love it. I love it. All right. So you did all this hard work when you were young, right? And you sacrificed maybe a lot of other things that younger people do as they're growing up. You went to college. You went to Seton Hall Law School. Great school. We love that school. You're in it. So what made you decide to not go back in that? And then actually what inspired you to pursue a career in culinary industry? What did you feel pressure from your family or?
John, it was like, you know, I went to Villanova. I graduated. I did very well in school. Funny story, everybody's applying to college. And my mom and dad, my dad worked early. My mom, both of them didn't go to college. And, you know, people are filling out their applications, taking SAT courses. I'm like, Dad, Mom, like, I should go to college. And they wanted me to go to college, but they knew nothing about the process, you know. And Cary Edwards, who was the governor of New Jersey, his office was across the street from the restaurant. And my dad called Cary and said, you know, what should I do, blah, blah, blah. He said, I have an inn at Villanova. Would he like to go there? He's got grades that are good enough, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, I looked it up in the big SAT book, you know, I figured it out. It was an hour and a half from home, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, that sounds fine, Dad. So he's like, okay, go across, meet, talk to Carrie's secretary, blah, 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 fill out whatever you got to fill out. The next day, I get a call from the registrar or whoever at Villanova, and I was enrolled in Villanova University. That's how I went to college. It wasn't a normal, like, okay, I'm going to go here. This is my safe school. This is Cary Edwards was across the street and had an inn at Villanova. And that's how I went to Villanova. So, you know, it was unusual. It was different. But when I went to school, I worked hard. I worked all the way through college for a hospitality company run by this guy, Steve Morgan. And I worked for them in Philadelphia, King of Prussia, and then in Margate, New Jersey, while I was in college. And then when I graduated, my mom and dad didn't want me in the restaurant business. So my mother wanted me to be a lawyer. So I got into Seton Hall Law, and I went to Seton Hall Law. And while I was in law school, I opened my first restaurant in Point Pleasant, New Jersey.
So how old were you?
I was 19, 20 years old.
Wow. So that was your first, and what was the name?
It was called VR Raw, RALWIGGIES, Raw Wiggies. It was like a bar and grill. And it was very, very busy. We ran it for about 16 months. And then somebody came and gave us a ridiculous offer to buy it, and we sold it. And then we came to Red Bank, New Jersey.
So while you're in law school, you're running restaurants. How do you feel law school helped you in your career? I mean, do you feel that training was a value add?
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, value added every single day of the week. You know, when I went to law school, the dean of the law school was Ron Riccio, and he lived right here in Little Silver, so close to the restaurants, and was a customer. And I said, Dean, why do I have to do this? I'm in the restaurant business. I don't want to finish, but. And my dad was alive. My mother was deceased. And Dean's like, you're going to need this someday. You're going to need this. And we became very, very good friends. And he's like, look, you do so well. You're excelling. Finish this. Finish law school. And I finished law school. And he was like kind of my mentor, like to just mentally to get through it because I didn't think I needed it. You know, and at that time, the stock market was going crazy from Villanova, two of my best friends went to work on Wall Street. One of them is a certified billionaire. Another guy is worth $300 or $400 million. And they wanted me to come with us, work with us. And I said, nah, I'm going to go to law school. You know, my mom and dad want me to go to law school. When I graduated from law school, same thing happened with my law school friends. They all were in acquisition, mergers, Wall Street, crushing it during the lightning years of Wall Street. And I went to the restaurant business because I knew I loved it, and it kind of fulfilled something in my soul. And I felt like I needed it, and I didn't know if it was going to be temporary or permanent, but I knew that I had to see, like, if it was right for me. And, you know, I passed the bar and did all that, and I'm admitted in New Jersey. I'm of counsel of a law firm here in Shrewsbury. I'm admitted in DC. So like I did all the right stuff. I still have my law degree. I'm still active, but I don't really practice law, but every day, like contracts, negotiating, just talking to people, you know?
No, writing. I think it's an unbelievable skill set to have, you know, in business. I mean, I think it's so worthwhile.
John, you look at almost every single major television anchor, all those women on Fox, they're all lawyers, CNN. Yeah. A lot of them have a legal degree too.
Yeah.
A lot of them because, right, it helps you, right? The Socratic method. Mr. Rallo, you stand up in front of people. Whether you didn't like to speak in front of people or not, you did not have a choice.
Yeah.
It forced you to learn to speak in front of people, to stay calm, to understand, to articulate your thoughts, whether they were right or wrong, it didn't matter, right? It gave you that ability to articulate your thoughts and what you thought was right or wrong, and it created conversation, right? So, and really that's what law school did, and that's everyday life.
I love too how your parents, it's almost like you were so pushed not to be doing what you're doing now, but you trusted your gut. So my question to you now is, you know, is that part of what your success has been, by trusting to your gut with all the challenges you have to do with opening restaurants, you know, customers and everything that goes into, you know, operating a successful long-term restaurant? I mean, most of them fail within the first 3 years, right? Very small percentage, you know, live on.
I mean, yeah, restaurants don't last long. Their longevity, you know, is usually not great. This is how I looked at it. When I came to work for my dad, I didn't want to run the restaurant that he created. But I knew down the road, I would get my turn, right? So some people are given a lemon, they cut a wedge and they put it in their club soda, right? Some people take the lemon and they make lemonade. Some people take the lemon and they make a beautiful lemon sauce with capers and garlic and shallots and put it over a beautiful grilled piece of fish. Some people make lemon souffle, right? So I knew from that beginning with my dad, that there was opportunity, you know, and I took the opportunity to create a television show that was on PBS for 46 episodes, 5 seasons. You know, it was Eat, Drink, Italy with Vic Rallo, and then it became On the Road with Vic Rallo. So I developed a television show. I developed a bakery concept, which I brought in partners and I sold to my partners. Up until COVID hit, we had 6 restaurants, you know, a very famous restaurant in New York, Esca, with Chef Dave Pasternak. That was in fact, our busiest restaurant, but we had to close it because it was in Midtown. You know, the theater was so important to its business. The related group was the landlord. They wanted to get paid, and it just didn't make sense.
COVID derailed a lot of things, unfortunately.
It derailed a lot of things. In Staten Island, when we could open again, we couldn't get help, so I couldn't do 2 restaurants, so we closed one. You know, so we kind of consolidated. But, you know, I took what my father taught me, and I took it to the next level. And, you know, now my son's working with me, and he went to Cornell to hospitality school, and I hope he follows. You know, there's many levels to what we do. You know, there's guys that, you know, that are in business like what you do, that start building houses, that manage properties, that build office buildings, that become commercial real estate. You know, they own them. Some people rent them. You know, there's so many things that you can do, and people get pigeonholed. You know, they don't have the wide angle lens open. You know, they're like this. Eventually you got to do this, right? You got to focus, but early on you got to have the lens wide open, I think. And then kind of work on your focus.
So talk to me about this TV show. Cause listen, I mean, everyone would like to do a TV show if they could in the industry that they're in. Talk about like restaurants not succeeding, you know, most of them over the long term. To actually get a show is almost impossible, especially when you did it. we didn't have all these streaming companies looking for content, and content wasn't, you know, it was more, it's harder to do. So how did that happen? What challenges did you have doing it? And, you know, how did it end up? And, you know, would you do another one?
Well, RIP Anthony Bourdain, because he really set the platform for food and television in creative ways.
I mean, look at the Food Channel today. It's an empire.
And so I met a guy and he saw these YouTube videos that I was doing. And he said, I think you could do a television show. And I'm like, okay, well, how do we do that? He said, we need to do a pilot. And I said, if I did a TV show, the only way I would do it is if it was all shot in Italy. He goes, you're out of your mind. I'm like, well, what's the difference if we do a pilot here or a pilot there besides the plane fare? So I said, if I can set up 7 days of whatever, wine, food, architecture, culture, history, and I can find someone that would be the film crew on the ground there, would you do it? I'll pay for that. And he said, yeah, well, why not? So a couple weeks, I found a film crew through friends in Italy. I found a place where we could cook and see wine and go truffle hunting and blah, blah, blah. And I put together a schedule and I said, okay, if we go October 3rd to 10th, I could put together a whole schedule. I'll have a crew. They'll shoot for 5 days. This is what we're going to do. Here's a shot thing. So he's like, I have an in at WNET and PBS. Let me propose it to them and see what they think. And so they said, if you come back and the quality's good, we would be very interested. We went and shot it. We edited it. We brought it back. We brought it to PBS. They said, okay. They explained how the PBS model worked. You have to go out and find sponsors, basically funding for the show. And if you find funding for the show, we'll take your show if you can do 6 episodes in the first season. So I did a spreadsheet, how much it would cost, et cetera, based on this pilot, added 25% for overage. And then, you know, I had very good relationships with wineries, Italian food importers, olive oil companies, cheese companies, et cetera. So I went to them and I'm like, would you give me $25,000 and we'll put some of your products in the front of the back of the show? The wine companies, the olive oil companies. And I got enough people together to do the first season. We went and we shot the first season in 19 days in Italy, came back, edited it. And we were on the first season, I think in almost every state on PBS channels. And you know, it opened the doors. The PBS model, you make no money unless you can really sell sponsorship like Lydia Bastianich did. Because, you know, she had bigger restaurants than I did, a bigger platform, but it built a brand, right? So how do you build a brand, right? It takes money to build a brand, but if you could do it with television and that's your source of building your brand, you know, today some people do it on Instagram or TikTok or YouTube. So then it was in the infancy stages of building brands that way. So television was the entree that I used to help build the brand Victor Rolla. And it was very successful.
That's amazing. I think about it today. I mean, if you look back, that's hard what you did. I mean, you had to have some network allow you to actually put your show on, whether you did it or, you know, got the sponsors or not. Today with YouTube, I mean, look at us now. Like I have my YouTube channel, right? I don't need a network to do it. I could try. Not that it'll be as successful as your TV show, but at least we have more of a chance. So that's amazing. So that helped you build your brand. You know, today you have all these restaurants post COVID. What would you say is the reason why they're still here? Cause like we know so many that have closed, you know, what's the difference in operating now? How has all these experiences candidly from your whole career helped you maintain what you have today and move through it?
Well, let's talk about COVID first. I think COVID was the hardest time in my life personally. It was fight or fail. If you were not ready to fight, you fail. We, all of our restaurants stayed open in the beginning to go only. Anybody that wanted to work and had insurance on their car, we changed our insurance policy so people could drive. They were delivery drivers. We kept anybody that wanted to work. And we did enough to survive for those two years. And during that survival, we learned a lot about ourselves and what we do and how the community appreciated what we did. Because we were the, you know, there wasn't many options. And we were there for the community and we did it well. And we did contactless delivery where the driver took their phone, put it at the front steps, called the guests, made sure they came out and got it. Or, you know, if they wanted to come to the car, we opened the back hatch. Whatever they wanted to do, we made it available. So that was a vehicle that some people just couldn't do. And I was like, if we don't do this, we're done. Because you still have a mortgage, you still have electric gas, you still got to pay all these things. And no one knew when it was going to end, right? So you have a year's worth of money in the bank to support yourself, your business for a year or 18 months. It's not forever.
Right.
So, you know, the unknown is difficult. So we survived COVID and I think it made us stronger and better. And the community really appreciated what we did. And the community supported us before, but now they really support us. Because we went above and beyond.
100%. I mean, it was the most tragic, crazy thing we all went through. And what I love about a lot of the stories I hear from it, whoever got through, I mean, first of all, their confidence level went up that they could do something in a way they never thought they could. You know, for businesses, it forced everyone up to the cloud, right? Like it forced everyone how to learn how to be remote, how to work more flexibly. You know, it really was a test of tenacity, and you got through it in a positive way. I'm sure you've learned a lot of things in ways to do that you didn't before. But this leads me to another question, because I think scaling anything is so hard. And you have multiple restaurants. And how do you maintain quality throughout a scaled restaurant business? We read McDonald's book, Roy, you know, I don't know if you read it. Okay. He had it in your level restaurant.
The thing with us is that we have always demanded quality. And the thing that I still control today at each restaurant is where everybody buys things. So in my restaurants, Chef John cannot call up his buddy, the produce guy, and get produce. If Chef John wants to bring that purveyor in, we sit with the purveyor, we talk, he brings samples, pricing, we compare it, and then we decide as a team. But he can't go on his own, right? So we have a lot of control that way. The fish guys that we use, the meat purveyors, the produce guys, those guys know how much quality means to me, and they cannot go outside of that circle unless I agree that that person is an approved vendor. So that's one way. I'm involved in all of the menu production and testing. So when a chef is making changes to a menu seasonally for summer, for fall, for winter, anything that we make, I test and eat before any customer ever looks at it. So in that way, I'm very involved. And then, of course, I have very good people that work for me, people that have been working for me for some people that have been working with me for 30 years.
It's amazing.
So I attribute the longevity of our help and our staff, our team, to working in a good environment. So people must like what we do and how we do it, and they stick around. So I think the combination of quality, the combination of that control over menu development and the great team allows us to scale. Scaling is very, very hard. Today, it's the hardest it's ever been because it's very difficult to get great help. again, I go back to the same thing. The work ethic of people generally is few, there's few and far between. So if anybody listening, if you have great people, support them and reward them because they're hard to replace.
100%. I totally agree. Especially the ones that feel like they own what they do with you, right? Like they have a passion for what the whole is, and it's a team thing. So I guess, you know, one more question about the restaurant life is there a, I mean, work balance, I guess you can throw that out the window. And I don't even know what the real definition of work balance is. But how do you live a life so demanding and maintain some semblance of sanity? Like, what do you, like, what practices do you implement to actually feel okay, knowing that, you know, it's almost a 24/7 thing you're dealing with?
Absolutely. My phone's on all the time, right? So, and it rings throughout the night if it has to. But one thing for me, when I got into this business, early on, I was captured, you know, I would stay up late and go out and blah, blah, blah. You know, chefs and bartenders go out, you know, and there's always an open door where you can have a drink late at night or something to eat. You know, it's kind of, you know, especially in New York City. And then I'm like, where do I want to be? I've chosen this life, right? Do I want to be really successful or do I want to go out and have fun? And at one moment in my life, I said, you know, it was like a party through December. My birthday's January 4th, through New Year's Eve, through my birthday. And like January 6th, I was like, this is it. It's over. And I changed my diet, stopped drinking, and said, I'm going to run a marathon. Just changed my focus. And in April, I ran, April of that year, I ran from January to April, I trained and ran the Cleveland Marathon. And I did 3 hours and 33 minutes. Like, I took my type A behavior and just solely focused on that. And it helped me change my life because you need time for yourself. And when I was training those miles that I were running, I was away from everything. So my ritual today is my body, you know, I'm 60 years old. My body's a little bit banged up from what I've put it through because I race bicycles and triathlon and climb mountains and surf and paddleboard. Any crazy thing that you can imagine, you can see in the background, bicycles, surfing.
Yeah, I'm seeing it.
Riding on, and today, every day I wake up, I'm usually up by 4:30 or 5 a.m., have a coffee, sit with my dog, no one's up, write my emails, write my letters that I write, do that kind of stuff. By 7, I'm in the gym, riding my bike, paddleboarding, going for a surf, something every day of the week, 2 hours, 7 to 9. I come back, I plunge in a cold plunge to help my body recover, take a sauna. Sometimes I get a stretcher, a massage, and then take a shower and start my day by 10. And I do it religiously almost every day of the week. And that time alone for my brain, for myself, is super important. And if anybody, and I've had this argument with, if it's not 500 people, it's 5,000 people. I don't have time for this. If you do not make time for this, you're not going to have your sanity and you truly cannot be successful. You look at, you know, all of these CEOs, every single one of them, they get up early in the morning. They work out for an hour. They have the right breakfast. Some of them get up at 4 o'clock in the morning because they're dealing with different time zones. They work out, they eat, they do their shit. They go back to bed for a couple hours, right? Almost every single one of them finds that importance of self-help, helping themselves through fitness, whatever that is, yoga, fitness, meditation, whatever it is, they find it. They need to do that. And I think it's one of the singular things, if you do not do, it's going to lead to your demise.
I agree. I feel the exercise, movement, like you said, whatever you do, you know, whether it's meditation, yoga, you need to get outside yourself, and your body has to, you know, feel that you're taking care of it. I mean, 100%. You have to make those decisions, right? Because in your job, you could drink every night, eat like crap every night, and you chose not to. And that's why you're sustaining yourself, which is good.
Right. Like, I always joke with my wife. We got married in 1996. My tuxedo from my wedding still fits me.
Wow.
My tuxedo, my friend worked for Armani back then, and he got me an Armani. I got an Armani tuxedo, beautiful. I could put it on today. It's perfect. It still fits. Perfect.
And actually,
it's back in style because the legs were a little wide then, and now wide legs are back in style. So it's full circle, and I could wear it again and still look good.
You can still maintain yourself. I love that.
Right. So I think, you know, like when you like, be careful what you wish for. Like, you know, people say, oh, I'm going to be successful. I'm going to do this. I'm going to have 10 restaurants. I'm going to have cars. I'm going to have a yacht, whatever. Just be careful what you wish for, because all of that leads to stress. All of that is like what's really important? Like, if you don't have sanity and you don't feel good about yourself, right? So all of those things, right, can come, right? But your health, right, your sanity can go in a second, right? So I think it's very important. Some people don't focus on it enough. I think it's very, very important, a part of my life, and it's very, very important, I think, to my success. I think I would drive myself into the ground. I would have too much energy. I would be uncontrollable. I mean,
well, no, you're tampering yourself. I love
it. In a good and a bad way, right? So I, like, some days when I'm really busy, I won't work when I know I have this, and I have so much energy, uncontrollable. I could go to bed at 12 o'clock at night, wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, no problem. The sleep thing is fine. The exercise part of it just calms the ABA.
Yeah, no, it does. It calms you down. The cold blood, you're doing all the things that, you know, to treat yourself the way you need to treat yourself, which is, is terrific. So I want to thank you for doing this. Before we go, Pasta Vino, when's it opening? Where can people, what's the address? How can people find it?
It's one stop from the ferry station in St. George, the Staten Island Ferry, free ferry back and forth to New York. One of the best free things that you can do in New York, by the way. The ferry is so cool. It goes past the Statue of Liberty on a clear day. You see Manhattan. It's very beautiful. And then from the ferry station, you could take one stop on the train and get off at Stapleton, and you're right there. It's where the old Navy Pier used to be. Pasta Vino is doing fantastic. It's at 37 Navy Pier Court in Stapleton, and it's a great spot. Great team there, great food. The consulting chef was a Michelin-starred chef, and I think the food is fantastic. It's right on the water. It's pretty. It's kind of a destination restaurant, but it's been received very, very well. And in fact, we're looking into doing another Pasta Vino in Jersey City in the next couple of years. They're building another building there, and we're probably going to go into that building.
Well, love the name. Can't wait to try it. So looking forward to trying it out. And I want to, again, thank you for being here, and have a good rest of the day.
Thank you. And I promise to take care of your daughter this weekend when she comes for her birthday dinner.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me on.
Hi, John Schultz here. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. Would really appreciate it if you would like, comment, subscribe, and share with your friends. Looking forward to being with you soon.